This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts. This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or stream us live on YouTube and Bloomberg.com.
All right, let's get back to the news of the day. We're going to talk about, again, President Vladimir Zelensky's visit to the White House. We're going to do that now with Angela Stent. She is senior fellow at the Brookings Institute, joining us now. And Angela, it's great to have you with us. As we've walked through a few different times, this is President Zelensky's first trip outside of Ukraine in 300 days since the invasion. Walk us through, I guess, sort of the signal there. Put it into context how important this trip is.
Well, this is indeed a historic trip. He hasn't left the country. He didn't go to the G20. He's gone to NOAA. He's done everything by Zoom. But I think he realizes it's very important to come to the United States. This is a crucial period in this ongoing war. The Russians aren't doing well. On the battlefield, the Ukrainians are doing much better, but they're also being pummeled every day by Russian attacks and losing electricity and water and heat and things like that. So he's coming to the United States to thank the United States for everything it's done. Without our weapons and our financial support, Ukraine probably wouldn't be where it is now. To make sure when he talks to the Congress, certainly, that they understand that Ukraine still needs their help because there is doubt about what's going to happen when the Republicans take over the House. And I'm sure he also wants to talk to the president. President Biden wants to talk to him about how does this go from here? What does he envisage is going to happen in this war? So a lot to talk about and symbolically very important.
You know, Angela, I'm thinking about Vladimir Putin in Moscow or wherever he is right now, watching this meeting on TV. Obviously, I would have to assume this doesn't play well in Moscow. Does this risk sort of a more aggressive retaliation type of thing from Vladimir Putin to watch this meeting take place?
Well, certainly his press secretary this morning said, the more assistance that the U.S. gives, the more the risk of escalation there is. You know, we've been so worried about escalation, and what we've seen the Russians do clearly is with this indiscriminate bombing of civilian targets. But short of using a tactical nuclear weapon, which I think the likelihood of that is not very great. The Russians want us to believe that they're going to escalate. They want to intimidate the Ukrainians and the West into not doing more. But I'm not sure that this really does risk very much more because, as I said, the Russians are not doing well on the battlefield. That yes, they can continue to bomb these civilian targets, but they've been doing that for the past few weeks anyway.
Well, Angela, talk to us about that a little bit more, sort of the Russian perspective, specifically the Putin expectation. When he started this invasion 300 days ago, did he have any idea or, I don't know, do you think that he thought we would be talking about this 300 days later?
Certainly not. He thought that they'd be able to take Kiev in 3 days and conquer the whole country. So I'm sure he had, in his wildest dreams, didn't think that the war would be going on because they totally underestimated the Ukrainians' ability and will to fight back, and they underestimated Western solidarity. They didn't think the U.S. would back, and its European allies would back Ukraine the way it has. So I think from their perspective, this was unexpected. The Russians now portray this war as a proxy war between Russia and the West. They see this as a war between them and primarily the United States. That's not how we see it. It's a war between Russia and Ukraine, and we're helping support the Ukrainians. But this is really feeding in to the narrative that Putin is telling the Russian public, that this is really the U.S. is guilty here.
You know, Angela, I know President Zelensky is in D.C. mainly to get more weapons in the fight against Russia. But boy, I think of that cold winter approaching and really already here in Ukraine, talk to us a little bit about what that winter is going to look like for Ukraine this year. And is there anything the U.S. can do to help them on that front?
Well, I mean, it's going to be a very cold, dark winter, whatever the temperatures are. I mean, there are people who've already been existing without heat, without electricity, and without running water in cities and in rural areas, too. But all the more that the Russians bomb them, the more that strengthens the will of the Ukrainian people to resist Russia. But it's obviously very, very difficult to live under those circumstances. So what the U.S. can do is, I think we've given them some assistance in trying to repair their electricity grid and things like that. But by providing them with weapons, and we now have announced that we will give them the Patriot missile, this is a defensive system, to shoot back the Russian missiles, the more that we can provide them with the weaponry to deflect Russian attacks, then the less they will, in fact, lose their electricity, and the less their infrastructure will be damaged by the Russians. So it takes a few weeks to train people to use these systems, but hopefully in a few weeks' time, that will help.
Well, that's, you hit on what I've been wondering. So we're providing support in the form of weapons, but as you mentioned, that requires training as well. I mean, is the U.S. providing that training?
Yes, it is. We'll be training the Ukrainians, I think probably at our Air Force base in Germany, and that's where they'll receive the training.
Angela, how do you see this all ending? I mean, is there any world in which Vladimir Putin just concedes defeat and walks out of Ukraine? I assume not, but how does this resolve itself?
Well, it's really unclear. This is a war that could go on for a long time. The Russians are digging their heels in. Putin's view is the longer this war goes on, the more likely it is that either the Ukrainian people will say, we've had enough of this, we can't live like this anymore, let's sit down at the table and make concessions. And the same with the Europeans, who are also suffering from high gasoline prices and problems also with the supply of electricity and things like that, as a result of the sanctions, by the way, that we've imposed on Russia. And so they're hoping that, he's hoping that the Europeans will say, maybe we have to rethink what we're doing. And the same in the United States. That's why President Zelensky is going to the Congress. You know, you have a lot of skeptics among the Republican Party who are questioning why the U.S. should continue supporting Ukraine like that. So that's part of Putin's game plan, is to wait for the Western resolve to collapse and then force the Ukrainians to make these concessions. It doesn't look likely at the moment that the Ukrainians are going to do this. Putin will never accept defeat, but in theory, he could certainly present this as some kind of a gain for Russia if Russia's taking a little bit more territory, but he doesn't seem prepared to do that at the moment.
And Angela, you hit on an important point, this Republican opposition when you're looking at what's happening on U.S. shores. And, of course, President Zelensky is set to address Congress later today. And we've been having this conversation. You think about Matt Gaetz, you think about Marjorie Taylor Greene, their opposition to the fact that the U.S. is providing any aid at all to Ukraine. Is there anything in your view that the president of Ukraine could say tonight in front of Congress that would shift sentiment?
Well, I'm sure that he's not going to be able to change the minds of people like Marjorie Taylor Greene. But I think apparently he is going to meet then after the speech separately with Republican and Democratic leadership. And I think what he's trying to do probably is to shore up people like Mitch McConnell, Senator Mitch McConnell, and people like that, who in fact are still very much in favor of supporting Ukraine. We shouldn't forget that until now, Ukraine has been one of the few issues on which there's been bipartisan agreement in Congress to support it. So I think those people will be his targets. I read somewhere that he might be meeting with Senator Rand Paul. Now, Rand Paul is an extreme skeptic on this, so I have no idea whether that would change his mind.
Angela, just so our listeners have a sense of why you know so much about this topic, talk to us about your book about Vladimir Putin for a little bit.
Right. So I published a book called Putin's World. And in that book, I look at Russia's relations both, and the subtitle is Russia Against the West and With the Rest. And in that book, I certainly look at why Russia's relations with the West have deteriorated so much in the last few years under Putin, but why the rest of the world, much of the rest of the world, China, India, the other BRICS countries, much of the Middle East, Africa, and Latin America, all of those countries, right, have not condemned Russia for its invasion of Ukraine, have not imposed sanctions on it, because Putin has very carefully cultivated relations with these non-Western countries, and that's really paying off for him. And that's why, you know, when we look at this, President Biden said at the beginning of the war, Russia will be a pariah. It's a pariah in the West, but it's not a pariah in the rest of the world.
Angela, really appreciate your time. That is Angela Stent. She is senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And as she said, she's the author of Putin's World, Russia Against the West and With the Rest. Really appreciate your time as we watch President Vladimir Zelensky's trip to the U.S. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We were just talking about President Biden's meeting with President Zelensky. Later today, Attorney General Merrick Garland will join a meeting with the two, according to Bloomberg reporting. That's because the DOJ has played a key role in enforcing some of the sanctions against Russia, which leads nicely to one of the stories on the terminal today. It's in the Business Week magazine, the headline of which is Russia and Iran are building a trade route that defies those sanctions. Let's talk about it with Bloomberg Business Week editor Joel Weber and Business Week global economics editor Christina Lindblad. They join us both now. And Joel, it's a big, important story again as we watch what's happening in Washington, D.C. with the Ukrainian president here on U.S. soil.
Yeah, it seems like a pretty well-timed story and very much adjacent to sort of the bigger geopolitical tensions. And what this story digs into was honestly, like, just it's a you got to read this thing either on your phone or in the magazine or online, so that you can see what this this trade corridor is starting to look like. And really what Russia and Iran are trying to do here is find a synergistic relationship that can actually be behind the lines, so that things like ports that rely on other partners can't be affected by sanctions. And so they've really come up with there's an existing infrastructure, but then they have very ambitious plans to expand what that looks like. Christina, how ambitious and what do they need to accomplish?
Well, they are planning to invest about $25 billion, and that is in widening and upgrading some part, like you said, some parts of existing infrastructure, like the Sea of Azov, which is the distinction of being the shallowest sea in the world, that needs to be dredged in parts. There's a canal linking the Don and the Volga rivers, also very narrow in parts and has sort of traffic jams there. We're seeing Iranian ships beginning to move through these waterways. So what they're creating basically is this internal, inland corridor rather, which where it's more difficult to scrutinize what kind of cargo is going through.
And where does the trade currently begin? And where's the ideal end point currently, well, and then also in their plans?
Right. So right now, this Sea of Azov, which is right north of the Black Sea, most people don't even, I think, probably didn't do it in geography in high school. And then the terminus would be on the Indian Ocean, because India is a key part of also, while not making huge investments compared to the other partners, it is part of this of this corridor, because already we're seeing, for example, there was a shipment of Russian grain that transited through Iran on its way to India this year.
And how busy is it currently?
We analyzed some data on ship movements, and we were able to track a couple of dozen ships from Iran and Russia that are already using the waterway. Some of those vessels are sanctioned, but there isn't complete data. But that's what we were able to establish.
You know, Christina, when I think of both Iran and Russia and their trade with the rest of the world, all I can think about is oil and energy. So I'm curious, what will these two nations be trading back and forth? I assume it's not a big oil relationship. What are some of the items that will be going back and forth?
Well, you're right. Grain and oil products is the foundation of the existing trade. But they've signed a bunch of deals this year, and they're trying to expand, you know, into like polymers, medical supply, auto parts. So we saw, for example, already that trade in the first 8 months of the year doubled between Russia and Iran. And there are forecasts from Russian sources saying it could go to as high as $40 billion a year if the two countries wrap up a free trade agreement.
And so, Christina, if the aim here is, or one of the aims, is to build sort of a sanctions-proof trade route, what has the response been from around the world? What has the U.S., for example, had to say about this?
Well, the U.S. Envoys, U.S. officials, rather, are already very concerned that some of the trade going through right now is arms from Iran traveling to Russia. And they're basically putting the world on notice that, you know, that they want to crack down on that kind of commerce, and also that other countries that sort of aid in this effort, in this larger effort, you know, will also be sanctioned. So that could be a concern for countries like India if they want to participate in this corridor.
Okay, so that speaks to, you know, how the U.S. and its allies could actually try and pinch this. What options do they have to exert influence and try and dial down what's possible here?
To exert influence with
allies to make sure that the corridor is trafficked not as much as the Iranians and Russians would like.
Well, I mean, like I said, if they could. If they would sanction, for example, Indian buyers of Russian wheat that was going through the corridor. That's, I mean, they haven't spoken exactly with that kind of detail, but they basically said, you know, if we find that countries are trading with these nations, they will be targets of sanctions too. I mean, the difficulty is that it's much harder to track, cargoes going through this inland corridor than it would be in the open sea. For one thing, the vessels are generally smaller because, you know, these waters aren't as deep. So there's going to be more traffic to get the same amount of goods across.
I was going to ask that about, Christina, about the ships involved in this. Presumably these are just Iranian and Russian ships. Are they sort of cutting out the global shipping industry, more or less?
From what we've been able to gather, yes, that's mostly what they are. Because, you know, ships need, for example, Russia has been working to give Iranian ships, you know, right of passage through its rivers and canals. So Russia controls some of these waterways, so not any country can go through.
And talk about India's role here. Sorry to cut you off, Joel, but when we think about this route that's being built between Russia and Iran, how does India factor in?
Well, India's made an investment in an Iranian port, but it predates, it's been, you know, the work there has been lagging for many years. So it wasn't done, I don't think, with any kind of larger vision of what was going to happen in terms of how these two countries were going to try to, you know, turn so much to rushing around towards each other and try to accelerate plans for building this route. But generally, there has been an effort underway for at least a decade to sort of knit together the countries in Eurasia closer together. And so India was going to be part of that in some form.
I wonder,
go ahead, Bill. Speaks to the evolution of the BRIC relationships too, right?
Right.
And like, if you can reach Asia a little bit here, maybe even South Africa through these terminus, you start to actually see that this could be, I mean, this is kind of the U.S. nightmare, I think, actually. Like, if they can actually stitch together a trade corridor that's sort of behind enemy lines, like, you might not be able to touch it that effectively, right?
That's right. That's right. I mean, it also shows, I mean, I think one of the things we've been tracking all year is just to look at how supply lines, supply chains are changing as a result of geopolitics, you know. So we've seen a bit through, you know, nearshoring and so-called French shoring, but this to me actually was a story that I hadn't heard that much about, so I was very interested.
All right, it's a great story from Bloomberg Business Week. That is, Russia and Iran are building a trade route that defies sanctions. Those nations investing upwards of $20 billion to ease the passage of goods along those waterways and those railways. A very timely conversation, again, as our Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visits U.S. soil for the first time, first trip outside the country since that war started over 300 days ago. Thank you to Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber and Businessweek Global Economics editor Christina Lindblad.
You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovek on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, one of the defining features of the economy in 2022, other than super hot inflation, it's been a super strong labor market. The unemployment rate came in at 3.7% in November. Let's talk about what the next year holds with Julia Pollack. She is chief economist over at ZipRecruiter. She joins us now on Zoom from Los Angeles. Julia, it's great to get some time with you as we wrap up 2022. Let's talk about the labor market in 2023. Do we get above 4% inflation, or are we going to stay resilient here?
Unemployment, you mean?
Unemployment. So it's been a long year.
The Fed is predicting 4.6% unemployment in 2023 and 2024. But it's somewhat hard to see how that will happen given the strength of the U.S. consumer. Right now, we're still seeing consumers with plenty of runway left, with very low debt service payments as a share of disposable income, and with very low delinquencies. And here's the most important thing that's going to happen in the next year. Workers are going to see a real wage increase, and that's because inflation is coming down more quickly than wage growth. And so actually, their purchasing power could expand And I think that will fuel strong, sustained, robust employment growth, despite some of the predictions.
Mm-hmm. Well, Julia, clearly I have inflation on my mind. So let's talk about that a little bit, sort of the link between inflation and what we're seeing in the labor market. Wrap those two together. What does that relationship look like in this moment? Does one depend on the other?
So the imbalances in the labor market are a key contributing factor to inflation, and they are a reason that we have seen inflation spread across the goods in the CPI basket, move out of sort of energy and food and areas like that where supply chain issues were to blame initially, and into core services now. But what we know is that the Fed's actions are taking effect. We can see inflation coming down now, and real-time sort of market rents, for example, real-time private sector data suggests that there's more cooling ahead. We also know that when inflation comes down, it doesn't mean that wage growth comes down right away either. There have actually been pretty long periods in history of real wage growth, because wages are much stickier than prices of goods and services. And so what we could see this year is that after seeing their purchasing power erode in 2021 and 2022, workers could now actually finally get a real wage increase, as they have been doing over the past 5 months.
Yeah, Julia, I'm wondering how you think we got to this situation we're in now with the imbalances you're talking about. You know, the JOLTS job survey, job opening survey still shows something like 10 million job openings in the U.S., you know, way off the charts compared to pre-COVID. Why is the job market still so hot, in your opinion?
Well, initially it was because employers rushed back into the market and demand returned much more quickly than labor supply. Many of the people who left the labor market initially, who were displaced, who were older workers, just felt it wasn't worth the effort to reskill and come back. And so we've seen many more people retire than would have been the case without the pandemic. We also are kind of returning to the sort of pre-pandemic downward trend in labor force participation that's driven by an aging population and retiring a set of boomers now. And then finally, you know, immigration fell off a cliff. Embassies and consulates were closed around the world. And immigration had been falling even before the pandemic due to the Trump administration's policies. And so the shortfall is anywhere between sort of 1.5 and 2 million immigrants who would otherwise have been, you know, working in the United States now. Mm. So the long-term prospects of the U.S. labor market and its size are not that great right now, unless we start making more babies or allowing more immigrants.
get those, you know, boomers back to work. It's always the boomers' fault, Katie. You ever notice that?
It's a nice change, right, from just blaming the millennials.
Yeah, I don't know. Let's go back to blaming the millennials. I'm closer to the boomer end than the millennial end. Making me uncomfortable with all this boomer.
But even, you know, even among working age people, even among millennials, we have this very worrying trend of working age men leaving the labor force. The decline in labor force participation among prime age men, I think, is perhaps even more concerning. And that's tied to things like this, you know, dramatic increase in drug use and drug overdoses and opioids and fentanyl and these very, very dangerous things. So, you know, hopefully this is a year where policymakers study the reasons underlying relatively sluggish low participation in the labor force and come up with some serious solutions.
Yeah, no, that's definitely been one of the mysteries, just tracking that participation rate. But sort of to Mike's previous question, why has the labor market been so resilient? And that question becomes even more pressing when you think about some of the headlines that we've been getting over the past couple of months, when you watch what's happening in the crypto industry, which it's whole idiosyncratic story, but you've seen a lot of jobs lost there. Then you think about the tech sector and some of these big tech giants either freezing hiring or laying people off. You haven't seen it work its way into the data. And is that because there's certain sectors of the economy, of the jobs market, that are still hiring and then some? Or how does that sort of wash out?
So when we talk about tech layoffs, we're talking about tens of thousands of workers. But in a normal month, 2 million workers in the U.S. economy are laid off or fired, typically. And since the pandemic, that has been way down to about 1.3, 1.4 million. And so we have far fewer layoffs and terminations happening in the economy right now, overall, in the aggregate. And that's why those tech layoffs are hardly even showing up. Also, when tech workers are laid off, their reemployment prospects are pretty strong. I mean, this is the cream of the crop. These are the most in-demand workers in the economy. And so many of them are finding reemployment remarkably quickly. They're getting calls from recruiters before they even, you know, sign that severance package. So that's why we're just not seeing, you know, unemployment tick up that much as a result of these layoffs.
I was going to ask you that, Julie. Like, what is the matchup between the job openings and these layoffs in the tech sector? You know, I would worry that you'd get laid off as, say, a programmer at Twitter and have to, you know, your best option is to go work as a barista at Starbucks or something. But I guess it's not that dire right now, that there is still a lot of openings in the tech sector for these layoffs that we're hearing about anecdotally.
About 3 in 4 laid off tech workers appear to be getting new jobs in tech based on our surveys. So, you know, there are still tech opportunities. There are companies that are profitable who are seeing their share prices rise. I mean, it's a small set of tech companies, but there are solid, healthy tech companies with strong growth prospects. And then even within tech companies, you know, many of them are laying off workers in their least profitable teams or functions or sections, but still hiring pretty rapidly in other parts of the business that are very profitable and strong. And so, you know, sometimes one needs to look at these layoffs as a share of employment in the entire company, and often they're not really changing headcount very much overall. And then in the broader economy, there's still huge demand for tech workers, both within tech and beyond tech. Every other industry, every company is becoming a tech company in America with a website, an app, and increasing amounts of data that they collect and analyze.
So what does it all mean for wage growth, Julia? You know, are we going to see sort of that wage price spiral that people talk about where workers are demanding higher pay, and so companies raise their prices to pay for that? Is that a risk, do you think, going into 2023?
So I don't think so. I don't think we're seeing a wage price spiral, because we are actually seeing prices come down. We're seeing goods prices come down, and we're seeing wage growth appear to sort of slow or level off. So I don't think that is too much of a concern. I think we've now given time for supply chains to sort of repair and improve. And so as workers now start receiving real wage increases again, that will, sustain demand for goods and services, but without putting too much pressure on their prices. So I think there's something called the beverage curve in labor economics, which is a curve showing job openings versus the unemployment rate. And what the Fed really wants to do is sort of reduce job openings, reduce that gap between the number of people seeking jobs and the number of jobs available, without pushing unemployment up too much. So far, they're actually managing to move down that beverage curve, pushing job openings down ever so gradually without really increasing unemployment. Mm-hmm. It would be a sort of a miracle if they managed to do that. That's not usually the direction that this curve moves, but it seems to be working.
All right, Julie, we've got to leave it there. That is Julia Polak. She is chief economist over at ZipRecruiter.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
You drive, stay in prison.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, we are about 18 minutes away from the close of trading on December 21st. Let's get some insight from Lisa Erickson. She is head of the Public Markets Group over at U.S. Bank Wealth Management. She joins us now on Zoom from Minneapolis. Lisa, we're looking at a big, broad rally today, but when you look across Wall Street forecasts for 2023, there is a lot of doom and gloom when it comes to the stock market. Where do you fall when you look at the balance of risks?
We're really more cautious on the U.S. equity market going into the new year. And the reason why is that, as you pointed out, when you look both at the macro outlook and the micro outlook, we continue to have some headwinds. Chief among them is the fact that we still have inflation while declining at relatively elevated levels. And as long as that remains the case, we're going to have the Fed continue to be more restrictive in their policy, again, maybe at a slower pace, but nonetheless really trying to tighten. So you combine those two factors with the fact that consumers and companies now have been having to deal with this tougher environment for some time. And it becomes a question, again, of how long the consumer can continue to hold out and those corporate profit margins continue to hold out in terms of maintaining relatively resilient levels, but not with without some slowing.
So, Lisa, what does it look like in practice to be cautious on the equity market at this point? Do you avoid it completely, just go all into fixed income, or do you try to find those stocks that actually do benefit from higher rates and pricing power? How do you sort of put cautiousness into practice in the market?
We're advising our clients to be underweight U.S. equities relative to their long-term strategic allocation. So we think, again, caution is warranted in how they're positioning themselves across asset classes because of those factors that we just talked about. Where we would put that money in term is relatively more sort to a fixed income, higher quality fixed income, as well as global infrastructure listed stocks, which would contain sectors such as utilities, it would contain midstream energy, transports, all of those kinds of infrastructure items that, again, tend to offer, like high quality fixed income, higher levels of interest or dividends. And so that higher level of incoming cash flow helps to buffer the portfolio in more difficult environments.
And so high quality fixed income, that makes me think of treasuries. And treasuries are interesting when you think about the news that we got from the Bank of Japan yesterday that they're lifting the cap on yield curve control. That spurred some fears that maybe if you think about Japanese bond buyers, they're such a consistent force in U.S. government bond markets that maybe they'll stay home if yields are a little bit higher over there. When you're looking long term at the fixed income market, do you factor that in or do you think those fears are overblown?
To your point, there are forces that continue to pull up yields across the globe. Obviously, here in the U.S., the Fed itself is tightening. And we have central banks globally, the most recent of which being the Bank of Japan, really having to raise their targets or their bands. Nonetheless, we still think that having that higher income cushion that can come from higher quality fixed income makes sense. And right now, all other things being equal, we would also lean slightly shorter in maturity, keeping closer to the benchmark because of those factors. But we do want to continue to keep an outlook. We do see that yields overall are quite attractive. So at some point in the future, we might actually look at potentially extending out that maturity profile of a fixed income portfolio. But right now, we're still on the relatively short side, again, because of the factors that you mentioned.
At least I know at U.S. Bank Wealth Management, you have a proprietary health check, you call it, of macro indicators. Could you talk to us a little bit about what some of the inputs are and what is that health check showing for the U.S. And some other parts of the world?
We do have a global proprietary health check that looks across the countries, whether in the developed markets or emerging markets, at how activity is going on in general sectors of the economy, whether it's consumer, housing. And for each of those sectors, what it does is it bottom up puts together a number of key indicators in each area. What we've really been seeing here over the course of the last year, whether it's in the U.S., whether it's in developed international markets or emerging markets, is we definitely have seen slowing in the trend of where those indicators are pushing. In addition to that, the absolute level of the indicators have come down quite a bit. So all of those are really just pointing to the fact that the macro environment has been impacted by, again, the tougher market monetary environment, in addition to just some of the natural deceleration that comes from the fact that 2021 was a big reopening year, and it's just hard to keep growth at that same level.
And so, Lisa, you're cautious on the equity market. Do you see any opportunities to go on offense when you look at equities, or are you mostly playing defense here?
One of the areas within equities that we do think, again, is interesting right now are more dividend-oriented equities. So in line with the theme that we had on the fixed income and global infrastructure side of, again, pulling some of that cash flow up front in what could be, again, a more volatile market, we see within equities, again, some of those dividend-paying stocks, particularly those with good ongoing dividend growth, really make sense.
You know, Lisa, I've talked to a few people, fund managers and strategists, who have said, well, 2023 is going to start out rough. It's basically going to be a lot like 2022 was. Volatility, inflation still too high, rates still elevated. But then they expect sort of an inflection point in the year where it's clear that inflation has come under control and the Fed might actually start signaling that they're going to ease eventually. How do you think about the year coming up? Is it possible to sort of break it into sort of a good, bad first half and a better second half? Is that a possibility, do you think?
Well, it certainly is a possibility that hopefully over 2023 things improve. And of course, for all of us, we do hope that's the case. When we look at the year overall, however, we just see a lot of uncertainty. We haven't been in a period like this where, again, the level of forecast uncertainty is high. And I think that stems from a couple of things. So one is just the fact that we've never been through a period like we've had where we had a sudden event like a global pandemic, you know, shut down the economy. Then we've had extraordinary monetary and fiscal stimulus leading to reopening. And then, unfortunately, elevated inflation because not only of demand, but because of supply chain constraints. So, again, how that exactly works out and the pace at which, again, supply comes back online, including in the labor force, mm-hmm. just really remains to be seen. So with all of that, there is high uncertainty, I think, about the trajectory. So we, again, believe the best place to start is right. a more cautious stance, but we'll look at it as it continues to move forward.
All right. Lisa Erickson, she is head of the Public Markets Group over at U.S. Bank Wealth Management, joining us on Zoom from Minneapolis.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or stream us live on YouTube and Bloomberg.com.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.